Thank you very much, David. I've reached a stage in life where I have to make a choice between seeing you and not seeing my notes, or vice versa. So I hope I won't be too annoying if I'm putting on my glasses when I decide to have a look at you and taking them off when I need to look at my notes. I remember going for years watching speakers who did that, and I thought, that's annoying. Why do these guys do that? But now I know. I've written this book, as David said, and he also mentioned I've written other books, and I'm sure many people are asking, how can we stop him so before he writes again? And so I'd like to give you a fairly firm promise that there won't be much in the future that I think I've just about had my say, and maybe I've had my say over and over and over. And so if I say things tonight that sound familiar to many of you, and you say, well, he's been saying that for 25 years, I apologize in advance. But I find that many people haven't taken these things to heart. And so I keep saying them in hopes that even more people will pay attention to them and take them to heart and perhaps act accordingly, because what I discovered in the past 6 years or so was that after 9/11, when it looked as if we had the potential for another crisis similar to those that had occasioned spurts of government growth in the past, I responded to inquiries from journalists and other people by saying that, yes, I think here's what's going to happen, because these things have followed a certain pattern in the past, and we now have the potential for them to follow exactly that same pattern again, and they did. They followed almost the same pattern as in the past in essential ways. Of course, every episode is distinct in its details, and the past 6 years are certainly different from, say, what happened during the Great Depression or what happened during either of the world wars. But in the way that I've analyzed what I call the ratchet phenomenon in the growth of government, they're all the same. They all work in essentially the same way and for the same reasons. And that's why I was in a position to make some forecasts in September of 2001 that are on record as what I thought would happen, that I think have proven to be, unfortunately, all too accurate as events have unfolded. It's not because I had some powers of prophecy or because I'm a seer. It's just that there's a certain logic in the way politics operate. And if you study history long enough, you begin to get a sense of what that logic is and to see that it continues to apply in certain circumstances. And those conditions exist today. And I'll say a little bit about that as I go along tonight. Now the title for tonight's forum that David gave is why are politicians always trying to scare us? And we could actually dispose of this very quickly and go back and have some more wine by simply referring to the great H.L. Mencken, who among probably millions of quotable statements said the following. He said, the whole aim of practical politics is to keep the populace alarmed and hence clamorous to be led to safety by menacing it with an endless series of hobgoblins, all of them imaginary. Now, Mencken was a master of graceful hyperbole, and And yet, I'd say that statement is at least 90% truth, along with 10% hyperbole. The whole aim of practical politics is to keep the populace alarmed and hence clamorous to be led to safety, because that puts them in a position to be exploited more effectively by the politicians and their supporters, which is what politics is for, after all. Many people have romantic notions of what politics is for, but I'm going to try to cut to the chase tonight and talk about what I think basically goes on in politics. Let me say, first of all, that the reason I've focused on fear directly in this recent book and in some of my other writing lately, more so than in the past, in which I've spoken about crises of different kinds, and it was obvious that in those crises, such as the World Wars and the Great Depression, many people were afraid. Afraid of foreign enemies, or afraid of loss of employment or income or something during the Depression. I didn't try to go any lower down. I didn't try to get down to discussing fear at its most basic level in the abstract. But I've tried to do that more in the last few years. Fear is very effective because fear is the strongest emotion human beings feel. We feel all sorts of emotions, of course. We feel love, we feel compassion and lust and what have you, but none of them can compete with fear, because when people are possessed by fear, it overrides everything else. And included in that everything else is rational thought. When people react in fear, they react, as it were, automatically, the way animals do. Fear operates at the most elemental level that we human beings, as animals, can act at. And so it causes us to act quickly and without a lot of thought, almost instinctively, not rationally. And that's good, in a way. Because if we didn't have this capacity, we probably could not have survived. Fear serves a purpose, as Darwin would say. If you're not afraid, then you don't react to threats, and you may succumb to them. So fear is not something we can get rid of, nor should we. We wouldn't want to get rid of fear. Aristotle said, a man would be crazy not to fear anything, earthquakes or the waves, and I think he was quite correct. But fear can be misused, exploited. It can be cultivated. It can be heightened. It can be turned into a political resource, and that's what I'm going to say something about tonight. Now, I'm going to talk about fear in relation to politics, and in particular in relation to the fact that societies have rulers and they have ruled people. The people who have the effrontery to rule us call themselves the government. They understand about fear. They exploit it and cultivate it. And whether they compose a welfare state or a warfare state, they depend on fear to secure popular submission and compliance with official dictates, and on some occasions cooperation with their enterprises and adventures. And I maintain that without popular fear, no government could endure more than 24 hours. If we weren't afraid of anything, what would we need with government? We would all be able to rely on our own actions and measures and devices. We might cooperate with others in the process, but we wouldn't need what we know as government. What we know as government is is basically organized robbery. Now, when we talk about the bedrock of government, many learned people over the ages have maintained that government rests on public opinion. In fact, this goes back for centuries that we can find people maintaining this position. Certainly, David Hume is one of the most famous people to develop the thought that all government rests on public opinion. But many others have endorsed his argument. I'm going to maintain that public opinion, I'm not going to dispute what Hume and others have said, but to maintain that but public opinion is not the rock bottom, that there's something even below public opinion, and that that something is fear, more primordial, deeper. Murray Rothbard, in his brilliant essay on the anatomy of the state, considered fear, but he did not consider it the foundation of government. He considered it one device among several that governments use to keep people in line, another successful device, he called it, to obtain people's acquiescence in their domination. Every ideology endows government with legitimacy, requires, however, I maintain, and is infused by some kinds of fear. Fear is a necessary, though perhaps not a sufficient condition for the viability of government as we know it. Of course, ideologies involve not just fears but hopes. But when we look at what it is people hope for, we can often see that what they hope for is a release from their fears. And a very interesting writer named David Altide, I'm not sure he pronounces his name that way, but David Altide has remarked that people do want to be saved and freed, but they want to be saved and freed from fear. And this is what makes the mass media's messages of fear so compelling and important for public policy and the fabric of our social life, end quote. Altide has written a very interesting book on how the mass media contribute to the maintenance of a state of chronic fear and apprehension in modern populations. And for years I've been struck by this phenomenon. Once upon a time, I used to watch while eating my lunch something called Headline News. Now, this is not what I would call a highly intellectual news program, something like the USA Today version of the news. I watched it to just find out whether something truly big might have happened that day that I needed to take note of. But as I watched it day after day, I became aware after a while that there was always some story on Headline News that I eventually called the fear du jour. There was always some new threat that they had just announced, you know, a scientist had discovered that pigeon flu was about to kill us all, or that there was some new toxin in the water in Newark, and it looked as if it would wipe out New Jersey by sundown. And every day it was something like this, and almost every day a new one, too, the endless number of fears du jour. And so after a while I got ready, I got primed. It was like a research project, and I said, okay, what'll it be today? Now, of course, in retrospect, it's interesting that the world's population has not been wiped out yet, despite hundreds of CNN warnings that it was impending. That, you know, here we are, more numerous than ever, with higher incomes and standards of living. How could this be? I don't know how we managed to avoid all of these horrible fates that the television producers had in mind for us day by day. There's an old saying in the newspaper business: if it bleeds, it leads. Okay? So if there's been a murder, or there's been a fire, you know, any horrible bad thing that's happened, that's what gets the headline on the front page. And, of course, television news people do the same thing. For 6 years, I lived in a little town north of Philadelphia, and I'd watch the nightly news on a Philadelphia TV station, and my wife and I came to refer to the fire, because every night on TV there was a fire story. It's as if, you know, there weren't enough warehouses in Philadelphia to keep this going. But every night another one would burn up, and there'd be tremendous film footage of these flames leaping into the night air. Apparently people never tire of these images, and it can become almost humorous after a while, but I think we need to appreciate that it serves a purpose, that it gets people used to a chronic state of apprehension, of thinking that there are bad things out there happening, and they could happen to me. Without their thinking too hard about what the odds are that they're going to happen to you. Right? It's true, there are quite a few murders every day in the United States. But it's a country of 300 million people. What are the odds? Somebody's going to murder you tomorrow. Not very high, particularly if you stay out of certain parts of town. Your odds are very good indeed then. So the media are very important. If it bleeds, it leads. And I have my own little saying for television, which is whatever may terrorize, we prioritize. Just think how many terrorism threats we've had discussed or announced on the television since September 11, 2001, and yet there hasn't been another terrorist incident since then in this country. So I'm sure we're all getting impatient for the next one. One of my favorite writers is a man named Fred Reed. Perhaps some of you read the essays that appear by him on LouRockwell.com from time to time. And he had one a while back, last May, actually. This one was called Why the U.S. Government is Hated All Over the World. Fred is an American who moved to Mexico. He lives in Guadalajara, and he's married to a Mexican woman. And so he has an interesting perspective on life in this country because he knows it intimately, I assure you. Fred's a remarkably well-informed man, just astonishingly well-informed sometimes. But he lives far away most of the time. He comes back from time to time. And one of the points he made in this article was to say that a curious state of fear prevails in America, but it is a governmental creation, a calculated, manipulative Disneyland. He said, recently I was in Washington. Everywhere there were the artificialities of fear, the steel pop-up barriers in the roads, the stop-em bombs, steel poles on the sidewalks, the endless warnings to report suspicious behavior on loudspeakers in the subway, the searches of everything, the metal-detecting doorways, even on the buildings of county governments, of schools. Schools, for Christ's sake, what is wrong here? And, of course, the confiscation of shampoo at the airport. And then Fred says in his characteristic way, this is nuts. Look at how we're acting here. We're all acting as if we're under siege. Look at what we're doing to one another. You'd think there was a danger out there. And he also makes reference to the bullying of people entering the U.S. And he told a little bit about his wife, Violeta. Violeta had a visa issued by the consulate both times when he went to the U.S. Still, she got bullied by the border Nazis. It was ugly. I am obviously not a Mexican, but I get the same hostile questioning as to where I'm going, why I was in Mexico, and so on. It is none of their business where I go in my country, or shouldn't be. But there are no limitations on governmental powers now. A friend married to a Mexicana, again with a visa, got separated from her, and both got abusive questioning, and she came out crying. America was not like this. Now it is. Okay? And I think Fred is absolutely right. It wasn't like this, and now it is, and it's this way everywhere we go. I live in a small town or outside a small town in southeast Louisiana, and I can't go into my damn courthouse without passing through a bunch of armed men who make me partially disrobe and glare at me and menace me and threaten me to empty my pockets. You know, what is going on here? What is going on here? Do they really think Osama bin Laden is going to mount an attack on the St. Tammany Parish Count House, courthouse? It's absurd, and yet people tolerate this. As Fred noted, it doesn't happen by accident. An atmosphere of fear normally might occur after, say, the events of 9/11. People might have been afraid, but that fear would have dissipated. It would have worn away, and people would have eventually realized that it's not being repeated. Maybe it was a one-time thing. Probably there's no big threat. That's what tends to happen when some terrible thing happens once and then it doesn't happen again. People don't remain fearful forever because they were scared once upon a time. Okay? But our fears in this country have been revitalized over and over. I ran across an interesting report actually not too long ago, in November the 1st this year, which had to do with Donald Rumsfeld's operating style when he was the Secretary of Defense. Rumsfeld enjoyed barraging his subordinates with little memos. They referred to these things as snowflakes, Rumsfeld's snowflakes, and he was always dumping them on people as a way to goad them to go in certain directions or take care of certain things. You know, this sounds like the kind of foolish thing one would learn as an MBA student. There's always some kind of fad in business, you know. So now this year the MBA students are told to send out snowflakes to subordinates. But Rumsfeld, wherever he got this, did it all the time. And in April 2006, when he was under siege because a series of retired generals had denounced him and called for his resignation in newspaper op-ed pieces, Rumsfeld produced a memo after a conference he called with military analysts, and it said, quote, "Talk about Somalia, the Philippines, etc. Make the American people realize they are surrounded in the world by violent extremists." End quote. Now think about that. Here's a very high-ranking official of the federal government who sent his subordinates out to make the American people realize that they are surrounded in the world by violent extremists. We all know that there are people in the world who are interested in committing acts of terrorism. There's some here and some over there, and you know, they're scattered around. There may still be a couple in Hamburg, and there are probably a few hundred in Pakistan and so forth. We know there are people out there who would like to commit acts of terrorism. But isn't that a far cry in a world of 6 billion people from thinking that we are surrounded by violent extremists? That seems to me to call up very different imagery from my own personal appreciation of how many terrorists there are out there and how big a threat they pose to me. frankly, my appreciation of the threat they pose to me in person is so close to zero, I consider it zero. You know, it's obviously possible I would be harmed by a terrorist, but the odds are 0.000 whatever. Right? It's not worth thinking about. It's certainly not at the level of thinking about how carefully you're going to drive when you leave here tonight. That's a much greater threat to your well-being than terrorism's ever going to be. But we've got a government that wants us to worry about being surrounded by terrorists. And I think some people have actually, as a result of being bombarded by these kinds of warnings, come to actually be afraid of terrorism and to alter some of their behaviors as a result of that fear. Now, there are a great many public fears that we might take notice of. And when I talk about fear here tonight, I'm not talking about every kind of fear. I'm not talking about my personal fear that y'all are going to laugh at me because I'm a poor speaker, or, you know, Pedro's fear that Maria will turn down his marriage proposal. I'm talking about the kinds of fears that are widely shared by many people in the public, the sort of classes of fear. And I just made a small list of these things to use in my presentation tonight. And it includes death or injury at the hands of foreigners, death or injury by terrorists, whether foreign or domestic, death or injury because of environmental harm of some kind. Perhaps some of you have heard of something called anthropogenic global warming. Admit it, you've heard of it. See, and that's going to all fry us all in short order, and so forth. People fear loss of labor earnings because of unemployment, loss of income or capital from investments, loss of life or health from communicable disease, loss of income or social respect because of some form of discrimination, loss of cultural or language community, perhaps because of a so-called invasion of immigrants, harm from unsafe foods, medicines, or medical devices, loss of business income, destitution in old age, illness or injury in old age. I'm sure I could have extended this list, but you get the idea. There are quite a number of things that people are afraid of or apprehensive about that many people are afraid of. These are widespread. They're public fears. And the state then comes along and promises to allay the threats that go with these fears. They say, look, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you. And in fact, I'm here to help you by protecting you from the things that you're afraid of. They know the things we're most afraid of. Politicians don't know a lot, but they know something about people. They get out and press the flesh and listen to what people complain about. So if we're afraid of death or injury by foreigners, they provide national defense. And they want to spend quite a lot of money to do that because that's a big job. Death or injury by terrorists, that calls for a global war on terror. And when we've killed the last terrorist, the war will be won, right? I don't know. People take these things seriously. They're done in politics. Guys stand up on the floor of the Senate and talk about this with a straight face. I've seen it. Death or injury because of environmental harms? Well, we have an abundance of environmental controls to save us from those kinds of threats. Loss of labor earnings because of unemployment. The government provides unemployment insurance and all kinds of welfare for the unemployed. Loss of labor earnings because of an accident on the job. We have workers' compensation insurance and other ways. We have even vocational rehabilitation if people get hurt on the job. We have loss of income from capital or capital from investments. Well, the government has thousands of subsidies and bailouts to keep that wolf from the door. Loss of life from health from communicable disease. We have public health measures and health care insurance of different kinds. And before long, we'll have national health insurance in this country. Won't that be droll? That'll be really nice. People will love that. I guarantee it. Loss of income or social respect because of discrimination. Well, we have anti-discrimination laws to protect people from that. Loss of cultural or language community. Well, we got the border controls for that and immigration restrictions and related things. Unsafe foods, medicines, and medical devices. The government has provided us with the Food and Drug Administration and other public health measures to save us from those harms. Loss of business income. Oh, that's a doozy. Businessmen are afraid of losing income, so the government has provided tariffs, anti-competitive regulations, import quotas, price supports, tax breaks, licensing. It's hard to stop myself because there are a great many more things the government has provided basically to prevent businessmen from losing income that they would lose if the government didn't intervene and they had to simply make their way in the market unaided. Destitution in old age, well, the government gives us Social Security pensions. Illness or injury in old age, Medicare. And, you know, if I'd made a longer list, I could have matched everything with a government program that's going to take care of the harm hooked to the fear that people have. So the government knows we're afraid of things, and it's made it its business to relieve us of those fears. Now, I think about fears in several different general classifications, and I'm going to back up a little bit now and as it were, retrace the development of this phenomenon. One thing we may be afraid of is the government itself. I know I am. Obviously, a lot of people are afraid of some parts of the government, like the IRS. I've never met anyone who welcomes an audit. Or people may be afraid of genuine threats. I've been sarcastic here in mocking some of this, but there are real dangers in the world. There are real threats that people face, and people may look to government to deal with these threats. And thirdly, they may look to government to deal with threats which are spurious and may actually have been concocted or created or publicized by the government, even though they're not real or not serious. So there are certain classes of fears, but the point I want to make is that it doesn't matter what kind of fear we're talking about here among the public. Governments exploit all of them, whether they're real, spurious, or even of the government itself. Now, governments, people like to think sometimes that governments were formed when people realized that we needed government, that without government we'd have these problems we couldn't deal with involving public goods or externalities and so forth. That's the way economists talk about this. And so the philosophers used to think that they got together and they formed a social compact. And sometimes you'll read essays by journalists and they still make reference to the social compact as if there were one. You know, you can't do that. That violates the social compact. Well, what compact? I didn't sign this thing. Did you? what is this? So that isn't really how governments came into being. Right? For most of human history, there were no governments in the sense we know about them at all. There were just little groups of related people, that's all, that maybe 20, 30, probably usually no more than 70 or 80 people. And these little bands roamed around in the savannah, and they hunted things to eat, and they had a little bit of authority, like family authority. There might have been some, you know, the oldest guy who knew a little more than the younger ones, and they might have looked to him for direction or something, but there wasn't anything like we think of as government through most of human history. And what we actually think of as government didn't develop probably until what we think of as civilization began to develop. They occurred together, although most people are confused about the direction of causation. The civilization actually came before the governments, and then the governments came along to as it were, exploit the civilization. Governments originated in conquest and subjugation. They originated when people came into conflict, and instead of just running away, as they probably did for many millions of years, because that made more sense than fighting with people, just go somewhere else and don't get hurt. There's a big world out there, and there are only a handful of human beings, so let's not fight over one spot here. Let's go to a different part of the savannah. But eventually, people got thickly enough populated in certain places and resources sufficiently inviting that people did begin to fight with one another. And some of them were successful in suppressing groups and conquering and subjugating them and exploiting them. They might enslave the people they conquered, or they might simply take all the goods that the conquered people possessed, their foodstuffs or what have you. So governments were, in their beginning, just simple bands of robbers. But there's a difference between robbers in the sense of what we call roving bandits. You know, they go here and there. They find somebody who has something they think worth stealing, and they take it, and they move on. And government is what Mansur Olson refers to as the stationary bandit. Okay? He's the bandit who's not satisfied to take what you have and then go somewhere else. He takes what you have, and he stays there. And he says, and I want more tomorrow, or I want more next year, and the year after that, and the year after that. So the stationary bandit doesn't leave you. Now, subjugated people, for good reason, feared for their lives. Often many of them were killed in the process of being subjugated, so they knew they were up against it. And if the conquerors gave them a choice, you know, pay tribute or we'll kill you, they knew that the conquerors meant business, and so very often they chose to pay and to keep paying rather than be killed. So this is the sense in which people respond to government and pay tribute to it, because they're afraid of it. They're afraid of it. In this sense, government is not anything like a genuine protector. It's a protection racket, you see, because the mafia, when it comes around and says, we'll protect you, you know, what they mean is, we'll hurt you if you don't pay us. Your protection money is protection from us, pal. And, of course, if somebody tries to horn in on their territory, they may commit mayhem against the intruders, too. So this is one original sense in which government uses fear, literally by threatening people's lives. Now, that's good, of course, but it doesn't work well for long, because when you treat people like that, they resent it, and they look for ways either to diminish the amount that they're coughing up to you or to somehow hurt you, to sabotage your whole exploitative operation. If they have a chance to overthrow you or kill you, they take it. So this is not a good deal for the stationary bandit. There are better ways to operate, more reliable ones, easier ones. But to move out of this stage, governments need legitimacy. They need for people to believe that they're not just being robbed, but that the tribute they pay is right and proper, and that it ought to go to these rulers. In order to gain legitimacy, governments historically, and probably almost from the very beginning, joined forces with the priests. As far back as we know anything about governments, say the Egyptians, some of the early civilizations of the area the U.S. Armed Forces now occupy. In these places, the rulers were themselves considered to be gods, and so the people were in awe of them. They believed that these rulers, being gods, had powers that ordinary human beings don't have, and those powers could be used against them. So they were awed. They were made to believe that the rulers were not simply human beings exploiting them, but they were superhuman in some fashion. And eventually this kind of joining the priesthood to the warrior class, a uniting of throne and altar, served to legitimate the rulers. They didn't always claim to be gods. Sometimes, especially later on, they claimed only to be appointed by God or blessed by God or descended from God. There are all kinds of ways of linking rulers to gods. I was struck by a speech I ran across given by Kaiser Wilhelm to the German troops in World War I, in which he emphasized that Germany was the people chosen by God and that he was God's appointed leader, and that this was a divine war in which they were engaged, because it seemed anachronistic. See, wow, here we are, 1914, 1915, and they're still using this kind of ruler-God link in a blatant way. But it lasted a long time, the union of throne and altar, and in some ways it still exists. I don't know anybody who believes that George W. Bush is a god, but there apparently are a lot of people who believe that somehow he's divinely appointed. He says he thinks that, and other people, in the evangelical religious groups, seem to think that as well. They've given very strong support to Bush and his wars, thinking that he's on a mission from God. Now that worked throughout most of history. To get legitimacy from linking yourself to some divine source or mission, but rulers also found it helpful if they could make people believe that they were actually the protectors of the people rather than the exploiters of the people, and so they began fairly early to work at that. Now, that can get very confusing, because it's pretty clear that sometimes they are protecting the people. If invaders came into the area, they would often, sure enough, go out and try to get rid of them and defeat them and drive them away. And that certainly looks, at first glance, like protecting the people. But it was protecting the people in the same sense that a shepherd drives away the wolf from his flock. Yeah, he protects his sheep. But the shepherd does not recognize that the sheep have any rights. And indeed, he believes and acts on the belief that when it suits his purposes, he will shear or slaughter the sheep at his pleasure. Still, in the meantime, it makes sense to protect them. So he drives away the wolves. So rulers have done that for a long time, and it led people to the misapprehension that the rulers really cared about them, that they wanted to protect them. They were devoted to protecting them when they were basically just protecting their sources of income. The stationary bandit not only protects people from foreign invasion and sometimes domestic disorder as well, but he may invest in what economists call public goods. He may keep order. He may establish some kind of legal regime. He may stipulate rules that are useful. He may say, we all drive on the right-hand side of the road in this realm, and it's good to have a rule. Okay? He may build roads and bridges and dams and other things that are useful to people and help them become more productive. But again, people have been led to believe that rulers do these things because they have the people's interest in heart. But there's an easy rule that rulers can follow for whether it's in their interest to invest in public goods, and that is whether the additional productivity of the people that results from these investments will yield them a greater stream of tribute sufficient to justify the current cost of investing in public goods. So, you know, you can do this formally and compute present values and everything. I'm not supposing that Charlemagne did this, but I believe he understood the principle. And indeed, rulers for a very long time have understood the principle. The reason you invest in measures to make people more productive is because it will yield you more tribute. That's always been the case. To do otherwise is to strangle the goose that's laying the golden egg for you. That's stupid. Okay? Now, of course, rulers that have a very loose grip on power, you'll notice as you look around the world, don't do much of this. It's the rulers who have a very strong grip on power that have the confidence that if they give up income today that they could seize and use some of their tribute to invest in public goods to make people more productive, that they'll be around in future to get the payoff from those people's greater productivity. So you find in a country like the United States or a Western European country, governments invest in lots of public goods, whereas in a country like Bolivia, Paraguay, or Burundi, yeah, not so much, because the rulers don't have as strong a grip there, and it's not in their interest to refrain from simply looting people while they can loot, get away with it. Yeah. Now, this protection that rulers promise people is often bunk anyhow, and you see that bunk by one way you see it is by looking at the bunkers. I'm not making this up.